Broadcast journalism can report what's happening even as it happens, and detail by detail build a story as the pieces fall into place. This immediacy can be painful when events are great in sorrow and tragedy. The assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas in November of 1963 was such an event. It was Friday the 22nd, and Alan Jackson in New York and Nelson Benton and Dan Rather in Dallas were among those who, in the frantic minutes after the gunshots, told what they knew. Listen again to some of the voices of those moments.
President Kennedy and Governor John Connally of Texas were both hit by a would-be assassin's bullet as they toured downtown Dallas in an open automobile a short while ago.
Senator Ralph Yarborough of Texas, who was riding three cars behind the president in the Dallas motorcade, told newsmen that he heard three shots. He did not see where they came from, but he thought he heard three. He said he then saw a Secret Service man beating his fist on the president's limousine.
Dallas police and federal agents have completely surrounded a multi-story building which was on the motorcade route directly across the street from the scene where President John Kennedy and Texas Governor John Connally were shot a short while ago. Police say they have found four empty cartridges on the fifth floor of the building. Police with sawed-off shotguns and other weapons have completely ringed the entire area.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States is dead. John F. Kennedy has died of the wounds received in an assassination in Dallas less than an hour ago.
Cartoonist William Maldon drew the Lincoln statue grieving, head in hands. Even Stone wept that day. The president was dead and Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, but that was not the end of the story in Dallas. Sunday morning after assassination Friday, Lee Harvey Oswald, suspected of killing the president and a Dallas policeman, was to be moved from the city jail to the county jail. Ike Pappas, now a CBS News correspondent, then worked for a New York City radio station. He was there that morning.
There's the prisoner. Do you have anything to say in your defense? There's a shot.
Oswald has been shot.
A shot rang out as he was led into his car. To me, he appears dead. There is a gunshot wound in his lower abdomen.
Can we leave?
Here are some police officials. Who is he?
Jack Ruby is the name.
Jack Ruby?
Ruby. Carousel Club.
He runs the Carousel Club?
The president, the policeman, the assassin. All young and all dead, and suddenly the nation seemed much older. Martin Luther King was shot and killed in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968. His assassination set off rioting in major cities in which dozens of people died. CBS News correspondent Steve Young caught the essence of the tragedy, not in Memphis, not in the streets of the ghettos. He found it in a concert hall the night of the murder.
The crowd had moved slowly inside Carnegie Hall. Alumni and supporters of Tougaloo College there for a concert of sacred music by Duke Ellington. The proceeds were to benefit the nearly all-Negro school, which is located 3 miles outside of Jackson, Mississippi. But before the program began, there was a sudden statement from the producer of the program, Robert Moseley.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? At 7:10 this evening, Martin Luther King was shot in Tennessee. This was to be a gala occasion for a little Negro college from Mississippi appearing in Carnegie Hall with the great Duke Ellington. Martin Luther King, 20 minutes ago, died.
Seated in box 17 was A.A. Branch, vice president of Tougaloo. He sat stoically. His wife leaned forward and gasped, "Oh, my God." Then there was a silence that attends history as a jazz minister, John Genzel, stepped forward.
This evening, Lord, we dedicate this beautiful music which has words of freedom, the four freedoms, of love, of talk about Jesus and Mary and thee. Long live the King under the King of Love.
After Genzel, there was the music. I Wish I Knew, Lead On, O King Eternal, and Bringing in the Sheaves. Later, as the concert went on, George Owen stood in an outside hall. He is president of Tougaloo and was leaning against the wall. He said, King was trying to lead a nonviolent fight. I don't know who will replace him. racism runs so deep in America. Steve Young, CBS News, Carnegie Hall.
In another city, another man would tell another audience what had happened. Robert Kennedy, pursuing the Democratic presidential nomination, was in Indianapolis the night Dr. King was killed, speaking to a predominantly black audience.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight.
2 months and 2 days later, Kennedy, too, would be dead, an assassin's victim. When Robert Kennedy was killed in June, CBS News correspondent Bruce Morton was asked to compose a routine report about the route the coffin would take when it reached Washington at the end of the funeral day. Here is what Morton wrote.
The route echoes the life. From the gray Victorian stone of Union Station, where the train pulls in, it is just a few tree-lined blocks to the Senate office buildings. The old building houses the ornate, high-ceilinged caucus room where a young Robert Kennedy first won fame as counsel for Senator John McClellan's Labor Rackets Committee in endless, angry verbal duels with Teamsters Union President James Hoffa. Robert Kennedy's brother John, then a senator from Massachusetts, was a member of that committee. Just across the street, the new Senate office building where Robert Kennedy, senator from New York, worked. Then the motorcade will head down Pennsylvania Avenue, reversing the route taken in an inaugural parade, past the rows of government office buildings, the Justice Department, where Robert Kennedy served his brother as Attorney General, hooking around the Treasury Department, past the White House, which he knew well as his brother's aide, which this year he had hoped to win in his own right. Then south, past the memorial to Abraham Lincoln, one of the presidents Robert Kennedy most admired. And on the other side, Resurrection City, home of the poor people who might be called the special constituency of this man, so moved by the racial, the economic divisions which ran the United States. And so across the bridge toward the hillside of Arlington Cemetery. An echo has sounded through Robert Kennedy's political life ever since November 1963. It grew louder when he declared his candidacy for the presidency. Louder during his campaign as the harsh Boston accent, the familiar cadence, rang strangely yet familiarly through crowds in Indiana or California. The echo must sound most strongly across this last bridge, up the winding road which leads to the site where President John Kennedy is buried. There old murder and new murder will meet.
On July 21st, 1961, Pulitzer and Nobel Prize-winning writer Ernest Hemingway would have been 62 years old. But on July 2nd, he died of a self-inflicted shotgun wound in his Ketchum, Idaho home. Many of us at that time were sore tempted to write of his death as he might have written. One who surrendered to the temptation and got away with it was Harry Reasoner on a CBS Radio Network news broadcast July 3rd.
Ernest Hemingway has died in Idaho. He was an old writer who did not write much anymore and who had been very sick recently. He had been in a hospital, and then he had had to go back, and after the last time he said, "All right, you win," speaking to someone or something ill-defined but with whom he had a long acquaintance, and he canceled his reservations for the bullfights in Spain in July. He had never missed one of those times before for this kind of reason. He just didn't feel well enough to go. He died by a shotgun wound in the head. There was absolutely no one around when the gun went off, and about the only thing you can say is that it could have been either way. And if the way he felt was that it could have been either way, then it really doesn't matter which way it was. When he died, he was married to his fourth wife, a woman with whom he seemed to get along very well. There's no indication in anything he ever wrote that he ever made a big and essential thing of women so far as his writing was concerned. He knew a good deal about the relations of men and women, and he told you a lot about it, but his attitude was mature and romantic. And maybe it seems a little dated to readers raised on the books of the last 10 years. No American in this century wrote as well. He said this kind of thing about writing. A writer can invent honestly out of his own experience in a truer way than any real experience can be. And a writer is either honest or not honest, as a woman is either chaste or not chaste. Toward the end, he thought of compromising, and maybe for our purposes, he found out you can be a little unchaste and not hurt the major status of your work. There is no mountain named Kilimanjaro in Idaho, but maybe there ought to be. After the funeral, maybe someone will think about it.
Harry Reasoner's reverent parody reminds us that Hemingway was a special man, a judgment that survives the years. for he had, in wars and the dangerous corners of our planet, lived by daring death. Is there anyone else who could draw us to attempt such parody again? Edward R. Murrow was a major moving force in making broadcast journalism worth spending your life at. At the same time, he was its prime public figure. The most controversial broadcast of his career was a television documentary about Senator Joseph McCarthy's hunt for communists. In his closing essay, Murrow said the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and that the junior senator from Wisconsin had stepped over it repeatedly. March 9th, 1954.
We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
In 1961, Murrow left CBS to head the U.S. Information Agency. In 1963, he was operated on for cancer. On Tuesday, April 27, 1965, he died. The Sunday before had been his 57th birthday. We remember that high, furrowed forehead, the ever-present cigarette, the short, lean sentences, the vivid description, the courage, and the dedication. If I may quote myself from that day when he died, he was a shooting star, and we will live in his afterglow a very long time. Just before midnight, July 25, 1956, in the Atlantic, south of Nantucket, the Swedish liner Stockholm and the Italian liner Andrea Doria collided in fog. The Stockholm's ice-cutting prow mortally wounded the Italian vessel, but the Andrea Doria did not die at once. In the morning of the 26th, the ship was still afloat, tilted over and sinking. CBS News correspondent Douglas Edwards arrived over the scene in a Navy plane a little before 10 a.m., just in time to witness the final moments.
Our Navy skipper dipped the plane down to 500 feet, and there below, on glass-like water, but water strewn with wreckage and oil, was the Andrea Doria listing at a 45-degree angle and taking water by the minute. She was listing to starboard, the ugly gash in her side covered by the Atlantic. A couple of miles away was the Stockholm, her bow stove in, limping to port. Her passengers watching from the forecastle. We made another pass over the Andrea Doria. Her three swimming pools were empty of water, empty the hard way, spilled into the ocean. Word came from the skipper that the Andrea Doria was done for in a matter of minutes, in his opinion. It was then a few minutes past 10 o'clock. On the next pass, the ship's list was at 50 degrees. Her funnels were taking water. Then down further at the bow, the boiling green foam increasing. 3 minutes later, the Andrea Doria settled gracefully below the smooth Atlantic, a terrible sight to see. A Navy commander had tears in his eyes. Nobody felt anything but an awful helplessness. There was nothing to be thankful for. The loss of life was not nearly as great as it might have been. At 10:09, it was all over. The Andrea Doria was gone.
Douglas Edwards. 1,709 passengers and crew were on board the Andrea Doria on the collision voyage. After the accident, the Stockholm sent its lifeboats, and they rescued more than 500. The liner Ile-de-France sped to the scene, taking on 753. Other vessels turned to rescue too. When it was over, some 50 people were counted dead. 50 people and one proud ship. Alabama Governor George Wallace did not want any civil rights march from Selma to Montgomery in March of 1965, but a federal court told him he must allow it. Wallace warned President Johnson he had neither enough men nor money to protect the demonstrators, and Mr. Johnson replied that the governor should use the Alabama Guard. But Wallace answered, the Federals ordered permission for the march, the Federals should provide protection. Mr. Johnson wound up mobilizing some Alabama guardsmen, sending in some federal troops, FBI, and marshals. The march started from Brown's Chapel Methodist Church, March 21st. It ended 54 miles 5 days later at the state capitol. Alexander Kendrick was there at the beginning during the march and for this report at the end.
It's dispersing now, but a second Union army occupied the Confederate city of Montgomery today. However, just as 100 years ago in another civil war, or was it the same one, the claims of victory were not matched by the concessions of defeat. The stars and bars still fly over the Capitol. There was no capitulation, and the scars of Reconstruction will remain for a long time. But it could not be doubted that it was a historic occasion and a nonviolent one. Many thousands of people ended the historic five-day march from Selma to Montgomery with a mass victory celebration in front of the state capitol. But though they reached the steps of the promised land and heard speeches from all their leaders, they were still denied access to the interior. If not physically, at least symbolically, Governor George Wallace kept himself in what had been the first capital of the Confederacy in his own office, though a delegation was named to present him with a petition. The speakers made much of the governor's absence, but after 5 days of foot slogging, sleeping in the mud, enduring soaking rain and blistering sun, many of the marchers did not really care. The march was from Selma to Montgomery. It had been impeded and prevented. Then it was allowed. They had undertaken it and made it. That seemed for most to be enough.
Alex Kendrick at the end of a voting rights march. The Selma to Montgomery marchers took with them for Governor Wallace a petition which read in part, "We have come not only 5 days and 50 miles, but we have come from 3 centuries of suffering and hardship. We have come to declare we must have our freedom now." The 1920s presidential election was the first major story reported by radio. Ever since, campaigns, conventions, and elections have been big broadcast news. Robert Trout covered his first election in 1932.
This is Robert Trout at our election headquarters in the newsroom in New York. The results of the 1932 election now appear to be certain. The ticket of Roosevelt and Garner has won a clear-cut majority over the Republican ticket of Hoover and Curtis.
By 1940, FDR had had 2 terms, and it was still constitutional to try for 3. But would he? H.V. Kaltenborn.
For months past, there has been a contest of wits between the President of the United States and the Washington reporters. They have sought to make him tell what he intends to do about a third term. He has sought, by banter, persiflage, clever answer, smiles, and occasional silence, not to tell him.
Roosevelt did go on, of course, to win a 3rd term and a 4th. One of political history's most famous feats of mimicry was at Kaltenborn's expense, performed by Harry Truman after his upset victory in 1948. The president told how he had gone to bed election night.
At around about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason, and the radio was turned on, and Mr. Kaltenborn was saying, "Well, the president is 1,000,000 votes ahead in the popular vote we have yet to get. And we are very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by another 1,000,000 votes. And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
There were the Eisenhower years and the Kennedy years. Then it was 1964, and the National Republican Party was under new management. Robert Trout.
The final demonstration on this night of nominations, as just as we had expected, South Carolina did it and put him over. It's the Goldwater Party now. Barry Goldwater is the Republican candidate for the presidency.
1964 was a Johnson landslide, but 1968 was something else. With third-party candidate George Wallace taking some of the popular vote and some electoral votes, there was doubt for a while that the 68 presidential election could be decided this side of the House of Representatives. We waited late into election night. Neil Strasser.
The CBS News election estimate gives the state of Illinois and its 26 electoral votes to Richard Nixon. And if I add that up right, it's 287 electoral votes, 17 over the top.
That was the year we heard a lot about changing the way we choose presidents. But crisis past was crisis forgotten, and nothing was done. a decade beset with war and doubt and assassination, the flight of Apollo 11 was a flat-out, easily understood success. The country had tried to wipe out poverty and racism and failed. It vowed to send men to the moon and succeeded. July 16, 1969 was the launch date for astronauts Neil Armstrong, Edwin Aldrin, and Michael Collins. Liftoff time approached, and Reed Collins was there.
We're down to 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. We should see fire. 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have tremendous flame out there. And we have liftoff. She's rising. She's yawing now to clear the tower. That slight yaw. Now the huge tail is passing the tower. She's lifting up. We have tower clear. We have tower clear. We're beginning to feel the first thunderous roar.
They were on their way to a destination 241,000 miles distant on the Sea of Tranquility. For the Earthbound, there were days of waiting as a spacecraft followed its trajectory, eventually going into orbit around the moon. Then the lunar module with Armstrong and Aldrin left Collins and the command ship and dropped towards the moon.
Contact light?
Contact light.
Okay, engine stop.
Stop the engine.
At a descent. Hose control, both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
They're on the moon.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Neil Armstrong's normal heart rate was 77. At touchdown, it was 156. He and Aldrin could not wait to get outside, so the hatch was opened early.
I'm at the foot of the ladder.
We had waited for this moment, then stayed up late. You'll remember. July 20th, 1969.
Well, there he is. He's on the moon. Has he stepped with that left foot away? It's a little difficult to tell.
I'm going to step off the land now.
He's done it.
That's one small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.
Armstrong told us later he had said or meant to say, one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. Other manned flights to the moon followed this first one, and there was talk of manned ventures deeper into space. But the nation no longer seemed excited. We asked for the moon and got it. That seemed to be enough.